You're listening to Program to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica with your host, Jimmy Falun Gong. This is Premium Episode 11, Rebellion in Patagonia, Part 1, or Me Going Back for More General Strikes. Today I'm recording from Rio Gallegos, Santa Cruz. In Premium Episode 9, I talked about the rise of class struggle in Argentina up to 1909, when Colonel Falcon ordered the military to fire upon workers during a May Day demonstration. In response, and due to the failure of civil society to exact justice, Simon Radowitzky tossed a bomb into Colonel Falcon's carriage, killing him. Then, in 1910, Argentina declared martial law and sought to crush the workers' movement. The workers stood a better chance because Argentina's oligarchy was divided into competing factions because of an economic crisis. I mean, arguably, there are usually always different cliques in the ruling classes, right? And that's usually based along whatever property they happen to own. Like, usually different cliques will, you know, fight, often based on different industries, right? But in Argentina, the divide was particularly strong. Hipólito Yrigoyen, who we mentioned in Episode 9, who is Argentina's president, he ends up pardoning Simón Radowitzky, right? President Yrigoyen led the Radical Civic Union, which was a left-liberal populist party drawing from the middle classes. His party managed to be extremely popular in sort of like a Franklin Delano Roosevelt sort of way, and he would win by giant margins after universal suffrage was rolled out in Argentina, right? The difference was Yrigoyen, the self-styled father of the poor, had this approach in the 1910s and 1920s, so if anything, FDR would have been copying Yrigoyen. Last episode we talked a little bit about Argentina's unions, like the UGT, the Unión General de Trabajadores, or the General Workers Union, which was neutral syndicalist, and we also talked about FORA, or the Federación Obrera Regional Argentina, the Argentine Regional Workers Federation. That was the anarchist union, right? Under President Yrigoyen's administration, some strikes were allowed to win rather than be crushed, and the ones that were allowed to succeed were the UGT strikes, not the FORA strikes, for the most part. That was the general rule of thumb. In December 1918, the United Metal Workers Resistance Society, which was associated with FORA, they declared a strike at a factory, demanding higher wages, an 8-hour workday, and the right to overtime pay. The workers of the factory hired strikebreakers and armed them with weapons. The strike went on for a month, and then it got violent. The police went on to kill 4 workers, causing riots and wildcat strikes in other locations. This caused FORA to declare a general strike, and the barricades went up across Buenos Aires. The workers burned down the factory, city trolleys, and police vehicles. Bombs started exploding across the city. In January 1919, the government mobilized and sent in the military, and they killed an unclear number of people. At the same time as these worker uprisings and the military putting them down, gangs of upper and middle class Argentines carried out a pogrom against Buenos Aires Jews, and to a lesser extent, its Catalan and Italian immigrants. They marched the streets shouting Muerte al Rusos, or death to the Russians, because at that point the term for all Jews was Russian. As in Russian Jew, because most of the Jews in Argentina were Russian Jews. And they also conflated in their minds the Russian Jew with the anarchist and the Bolshevik. They invaded homes and beat, raped, and murdered Jews. This whole incident was known as La Semana Trágica, the Tragic Week. Like I mentioned, an unclear number of people were killed and arrested. The authorities reported 100 killed. Other police reports say 141 killed. Many journalists reported 700 people killed. Interestingly, the U.S. Embassy reported 1,500 people killed in total, mostly Russians and generally Jews. And the U.S. Embassy also reported a widespread number of rapes. Historians still argue over how many people were killed, and they usually cite between 100 to 700. From this point on, Argentina would have a strong and growing nationalist and proto-fascist movement. They wanted to deport immigrants, end collective bargaining, and overthrow the democratically elected government. Right after the tragic week, Rear Admiral Garcia organized a group called the Argentine Patriotic League. The Patriotic League quickly attracted police, military, landowners, and right-wing intellectuals, and they started working with police to break strikes across the country, but most notably in Patagonia in 1920. Let's get into it. For those who might not know, Patagonia is in the southern cone of South America. The left side is owned by Chile, but the majority of it, by land, is owned by Argentina. We're going to discuss Patagonia as a whole, and the Santa Cruz province in particular, which is the southernmost triangle of Patagonia, which is just above the southernmost province, which is Tierra del Fuego. We talked about Tierra del Fuego in episode 9. We will also talk about Rio Gallegos, which is the capital of Santa Cruz, the province. For context, Rio Gallegos only had like 4,000 people in 1920. So, although it's the capital, it's also the sticks. Although it's also the big city in Patagonia, right? So, who owned Patagonia? It's a weird question, right? But it's crucial to understanding the story. Obviously, in terms of nationality, Argentina owned most of Patagonia, with, you know, some belonging to Chile. But in terms of who actually owned the land, in a legal sense, by 1920, the Russian Jewish Braun family owned the Tierra del Fuego Development Corporation, which owned a total of 1,376,160 hectares, which is an astronomical amount of land to own. There are very few landowners who own, like, more land than that, right? Included on that land, the Braun family owned 1.25 million sheep, producing 5 billion kilos of wool per year. They were also producing 700,000 kilos of leather and 2.5 million kilos of meat. They also owned copper mines, banks, meatpacking plants, insurance companies, power and electrical plants, telephone companies, and various other types of manufacturing plants. The Braun family ruled in conjunction with several other large landowning families who all knew and socialized with each other. Particularly prominent were the Menendez family from Asturias, Spain, and the Noguera family from Portugal. For the rest of Patagonia, the other 2.5 million hectares were owned by families from Great Britain, Germany, and France, and to a lesser extent, Spain and Portugal. Argentina was, of course, a settler colonial state, but in Patagonia, this is, like, different. Virtually none of Patagonia was owned by first-generation Argentines. Keep this in mind. Osvaldo Bayer wrote, "What invites ridicule is the idea, still being peddled today, that the repression seen during the 1921 to 1922 strike was carried out in defense of our national honor, our national heritage, and against those who, flying the red flag, wanted to internationalize Patagonia. Without any need for a red flag, Patagonia was already internationalized, not just by foreign landowners, but also because all of her raw material wealth was sent overseas." Power in Patagonia hinged on the following formula: land plus wool production plus commercialization plus control of transportation. That is why these same families that owned all the land invested in shipping companies and became shipping magnates. You know Programmed Chill's stance on shipping magnates. To quote Friedrich Ratzel, the Kraut who coined the term Lebensraum, at least in the sense that the Nazis used, to quote him, he said, "If you would rule on land, harness the sea." To that end, the Braun family acted as shipping agents for British shipping lines, and thereby they secured good relations with the British and their networks. Now, to understand the crisis in Patagonia, you need to understand that it happened during an economic crisis. Wool from Australia and New Zealand had glutted the wool market, and drove Argentina's wool profits down. That, of course, is the problem with an extractive monocrop economy, right? It's highly dependent on the commodity's market prices. For another thing, President Yrigoyen had to face the wool crisis along with a bunch of other problems happening at the same time. Argentina was the only country that voted against war reparations imposed on Germany, isolating them on the national stage. The Argentine peso's value plummeted and their economy was in the process of being pulled from out of the British orbit and into the US orbit. Bread prices kept rising while the peso bought less and less, and more people were starting to equate rising food prices with President Yrigoyen's government coming into power. There were more and more strikes, and many people perceived him to be soft on the Reds and the workers. Now, we talked about the army and the police and the oligarchs in Patagonia. We talked about the Argentine Patriotic League. And specific to Patagonia, there was the Rio Gallegos Commercial and Industry League, which was for general businessmen's interests. There was also the Santa Cruz Rural Society, which was the business interest group for the ranchers. Now we got to talk about the workers. The workers had the Rio Gallegos Workers Society, which was associated with the Fora Union. In Patagonia, they organized stevedores, cooks, waiters, hotel staff, and farm workers. At this time, Fora had split, like nationally, Fora had split yet again, with one group remaining more authentic Orthodox anarchist, more in the Orthodox anarchist tendency, and the other had split to include both socialist and Marxist tendencies. Now, in terms of the actual working class itself, there was the whole gamut of interests ranging from, you know, social democrats and Marxists all the way to, you know, anarchists, and there was even a very sizable block of anarcho-Bolsheviks. At this time in history, that makes more sense than it would, you know, later on. The Rio Gallegos Worker Society was founded in 1910. In 1914, their ranch workers went on strike demanding meals and the cost of broken tools not to be subtracted from their pay, and they also demanded access to medical care. So, like, pretty reasonable demands, right? All working condition stuff. This strike spread to many ranches all over Patagonia. The bosses brought in scabs and the strikes were totally defeated. They arrested 68 of the organizers. Nearly all of them were foreign-born, but again, as we saw, that's true for the bosses too. And just generally, like, people living in Patagonia, very few were actually, like, born in Argentina. There were meatpacking strikes in 1915. Those were defeated via heavy police repression. Then they attempted a general strike in 1917. This time the general strike was to try and end the bosses' and the foremen's use of corporal punishment on workers. This general strike failed. In 1918, they called for another general strike for higher wages. This time they won, though it came at the cost of several workers killed. In January 1919, they held a major demonstration led by working-class women demanding the release of their imprisoned husbands and partners. The women swore at the cops, threw stones at them, and they even jumped some police. When one police sergeant named Jesus Sanchez arrested the chief organizer of the demonstration, a 31-year-old widow and cook, a Spaniard named Pilar Martinez, kicked him in the balls. As the police report says, it produced a painful contusion, rendering him unfit for duty for 2 days, but should heal without any long-term consequences for the patient. Osvaldo Bayer, hilarious as always, wrote, "Sergeant Jesus Sanchez's honor was saved. Heaven forbid that this police officer should lose the virility that he demonstrated so well by beating women." So we see things heating up in Patagonia with the workers' movement, which had secured several failures but one or two major victories. As these things happen, workers engaged in real struggles, have their eyes opened to the true nature of things. In the struggle, they see things as they really are. They saw that they could not rely on President E. Grigoyan and his radical civic union, and they saw that no one else was coming to save them, that they would have to work together and rely on each other. More crucially, they saw that they needed to coordinate between regions and support each other. Another important figure in this story is Judge Vinyas, who was a dedicated radical civic union party member. He was in Patagonia as one of the head judges there. And interestingly, at this time, separate from the workers' movement, Judge Vinyas initiated legal proceedings against two English ranching companies, causing a large legal battle. Basically, it was over taxes. In case you're saying to yourself, Jimmy, this sounds a lot like the Vesti brothers and their whole thing about not paying taxes. Why, yes. Yes, it does. This is a lot of the Argentine side of the same story, right? Now, there's a long story as to why Judge Vinyas was fighting these English ranching companies. But the long story short is that it was basically the Argentine middle classes picking a strategic battle against a sector of British capital, and that it was playing out in the courts. On the British side was the governor of the Santa Cruz province, who was named Correa Falcón, no relation to Colonel Falcón from episode 9. And this governor was defending the British ranchers, not like formally in court, but like he was on their side. Unfortunately for Judge Vinyas, President E. Grigoyan didn't back him fully. And of course, British capital is quite powerful. And Judge Vinyas doesn't have the support of the governor of the province, Correa Falcón. So they're fighting, and this is what's happening on the political level when these waves of strikes start occurring. Governor Falcón formally complains about Judge Vinyas favoring the workers in more and more of these disputes, and Judge Vinyas did in fact make several rulings favorable to unions around this time. Now, if you'll notice, middle-class Argentine power blocs were less oppositional to unions than the far-right police and the ranchers, who were basically in bed with British capital. President E. Grigoyan's whole thing was to make concessions to the respectable unions, right? Like, gee, I wonder if there are any parallels to U.S. politics, right? So this dynamic would play out again and again in Argentine politics in the future. Basically, a populist would stoke these, you know, class struggles, support them partially, but mainly in order to consolidate their own position. Perón, etc., right? Now then, the Rio Gallegos Workers' Society, which was led at this point by a man named Antonio Soto, the union obtained a printing press. So they started publishing radical material. They also began to fly the red flag over their headquarters. In September 1920, they scheduled a memorial for the Catalan pedagogue Francisco Ferrer, who was an early innovator of secular education. Tragically, he was actually executed by Spanish and Catholic reactionary forces in Spain's Tragic Week in 1909, separate from the Argentine Tragic Week, right? So they want to have a memorial for him. This memorial sets off quite the chain of events. So right off the bat, the police do not issue a permit for the memorial, but the workers refuse to be stopped. And what do? Issue another general strike. This time, things got very serious very fast. The police and the army mobilized and surrounded the union's office. The union appealed to Judge Vinyas, as of course there's no legal ground as to why they should have been denied the right to meet and remember Francisco Ferrer, right? Judge Vinyas reversed the police's decision and sends news of this ruling to the governor. The police were very pissed off, and they were not in a mood to back down. So they went and arrested the union and its members again, during a different assembly. The pretext this time was that they yet again did not get a permit. They had a plan to then deport the troublemaking immigrant organizers. What do the workers do? They launch another general strike. You already know. Judge Vinas ordered the governor, Correa Falcon, to immediately free the arrestees. The governor refuses to carry out the judge's orders. This basically causes a constitutional crisis in the government while a general strike was happening. This causes the police to basically act more and more like without any pretense of law and order. The federal government under President Yrigoyen then chose to back up Judge Vinas this time, so the police had to release the Union prisoners. The Union kept up with their general strike to free more of their leaders, and they actually succeeded in getting everyone released on November 1st, 1920. Now, the timeline's going to start being important, so take note. 2 days later, someone tried to assassinate the Union's Secretary General, Antonio Soto. This failed, but when assassination attempts come around, you know that powers are being threatened, right? The Workers' Society knew they were close, and they were ready to go on the offensive and win some demands. They planned a new general strike for two demands: better pay for retail workers, and a full list of demands for farm workers. And it should go without saying that these general strikes are getting increasingly serious and well-organized, right? The bosses and the upper classes start to form a volunteer militia to help the police, for the sake of order and as a guardian of morality, of course. They formed it along the same lines to the Patriotic League. And in some places, it was literally just the Patriotic League, now in Patagonia. But they could not stop the general strike either. The three leading ranchers in this particular strike, they announced that they could not come to terms with the Union. Meanwhile, I should introduce two leaders for the rural strikes, separate from but working with the Rio Gallegos Workers' Society, which is to say, separate from Antonio Soto. Among the ranch workers was El 68, also known as 68. His nickname came from his inmate number at Ushai prison. His real name was Jose Aicardi. He was known among the workers as an accomplished horse rider. The other was named El Toscano, also known as Alfredo Fonte, who was a 33-year-old teamster whose parents had brought him to Argentina when he was just 3 years old. Both 68 and El Toscano came across as more gaucho, which is to say more Argentine, than most of the other workers, and they were therefore good spokesmen. They were also popular. They were also known as fair to their fellow workers. They also had some exposure to the harsher side of life. You know, 68 had been to prison, and they were not strangers to gunplay. Now, there's a whole host of additional interesting workers that you can read about in the book Patagonia Rebelde. This would make an incredibly interesting movie, but I'm going to skip, you know, some of them because they're not as crucial to the story. Now, together, they completely shut down all ranches south of the Rio Santa Cruz. Like, we're talking a major portion of the country's economy. And it's also a major portion of the world economy. So on November 17th, the ranchers offered to recognize the Union, but they refused to agree to their actual demands. The Union pointed out that they wanted a clear agreement with no room for doubt or generalities. So they sent their counteroffer. Their counteroffer was pretty reasonable. They were asking for a limit on the number of beds that could be in a given room of workers' quarters. They required that a bathroom be available, that ranch workers get 3 square meals a day, bedding, the right not to work in emergency weather. They asked for access to first aid kits and the right to a ticket back to wherever they were hired from, and reasonable wage requests. Like, this isn't really crazy stuff, right? Like, half of this is covered in OSHA, right? Now, along with this counteroffer, the Union published a pamphlet called To the Civilized World. And the pamphlet explained their reasons for striking, their goals and aims, and this was intended for the public. And especially, like, the public in Buenos Aires, right? the strike committee issued a proclamation to their workers, which I will quote from. "Workers, now more than ever, we must display our unyielding will to assert our dignity and be regarded by society as the most efficient champions of progress and civilization. We must marshal our forces, move forward, and staunchly defend our vulnerable and unrecognized rights. Whenever we see a comrade who is fearful or hesitant, let us not burden him with reproaches or threats, but strive to strengthen his resolve, lift up his spirits, and offer him the fraternal and loving embrace of his fellow unfortunates. Now more than ever, we must display our cultivation and education, of which so few proofs have been offered, by setting aside violence and coercion, and neither using nor abusing the use of force. Let the latter be the final symptom of the lack of conscience on the part of the bosses, as it is widely known that whenever they are presented with the just demands of workers, they see a terrifying specter and immediately turn to bayonets, rifles, and men in uniform. They cannot be too certain of the justice of their cause when they resort to such measures. Let us counter the strength of arms with the strength of our arguments, the righteousness of our conduct, and the integrity of our actions, and victory shall be ours." The Strike Committee. By November 24th, Mauricio Braun and Alejandro Menendez, of the two largest ranch families, right? They showed up and announced that they were going to bring in strike breakers and scabs. When the first scabs showed up at the Douglas Ranch, note the British name, armed horsemen rode up on them and fired in the air and rode off, scaring the scabs and keeping them from, you know, scabbing. On December 2nd, after the scabs didn't work out, at least for now, some of the ranchers made an offer to accept almost all of the terms. At the same time, President Yrigoyen replaced almost all of Governor Correa's functionaries, including the police commissioner. The union viewed this as good news, and they viewed it as support. So they rejected the ranchers' counteroffer. They said no, all of it. And they were in a very strong position, I should also state. The strikes kept spreading across more and more of Patagonia. The ranchers were growing increasingly worried. They started calling the strikers bandits, which, you know, is a bad sign. Then something very curious happened. Someone bombed the home of the prominent citizen, I'm doing air quotes here, dear listener, the prominent citizen Juan Albornoz, who is the local president of the Argentine Patriotic League, something that the workers did not need to do, given that they were on the verge of winning. I'm not saying, you know, false flag, but I really doubt that on the verge of victory they were going to bomb, you know, the house of one of their main enemies, right? Then, at a town named Puerto Deseado, violence erupted. Puerto Deseado was an interesting case because, unlike most of the strikes happening in ranches, where it was just bosses and workers and, you know, some foremen, Puerto Deseado was a town run by a clique of bosses and some highly paid professionals. The bosses were known as the Argentine Circle, which of course is a misnomer because they were not Argentine. At least not by birth, right? The Argentine Circle was busy squeezing the working class, obviously, but they were also squeezing the shopkeepers and artisans. In other words, unlike in the other situation, even the petite bourgeoisie were pissed off at the Argentine Circle in this town. This town was also almost completely all immigrants, including the bosses. Out of around 1,600 inhabitants, only 80 were born in Argentina, so no one could really use the nativist language that was normally, you know, trotted out, right? Conditions boiled over on December 17th when 300 workers were marching downtown and the police fired upon them, killing several and arresting many. News of this sent shockwaves through the Patagonian workers' movement. they all decided to double down and double down on their resolve to win the strike. And in Puerto Deseado, the general strike continued, if you could believe that. At this point, the police provoked a gun battle between 68, wherein the strikers shot several police and took several people hostage. Governor Correa, who was about to leave office in several days, he chose to basically pour gasoline over everything and light a match, because he issued a manifesto to all respectable citizens to organize and stop the subversives. The British community in Patagonia and Buenos Aires and across the country, they mobilized and they threatened to start pulling out their investments and capital. No one could forget that there were British warships at the Falkland Islands. Just in case, you know, they needed to step in, right? Now, as tensions were extremely high, President Yrigoyen sent in the Argentine Army and Navy. Curiously, the first thing the Navy did was to arrest all of the radical publishers, and I'm not just talking about the Union publishers, right? While the radical publishers, and by radical I mean like even just liberal and left of center, while they were held in jail, the Navy went and smashed up their printing presses and equipment. Like, forget, like, get out of your head the thoughts about, like, a free press or whatever, you know? We're talking about, like, literally, this is functionally just cutting off information lines, right? Like, this is literally, like, a military thing. Then, all across Patagonia, they issued a curfew and prohibited public meetings of any type. Like, just outlawing the behaviors that the Union needed to do, right? The Army, on the other hand, was a different story. They sent a newly created regiment called the 10th Cavalry Regiment. It had orders to pacify the South. The regiment was under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Hector Benigno Varela. Before Colonel Varela left to go pacify Patagonia, he visited with President Yrigoyen to clarify the details of his mission. As he tells it, he expected the president to give him secret instructions, the precise orders that must never be repeated outside that mysterious office. But as he tells it, no, President Yrigoyen just talked about radical party politics, some generalities about the Republic, and then the meeting was over. Colonel Varela, surprised, said, "Mr. President, I should like to know what I am to do in Santa Cruz." President Yrigoyen said, "Go, Lieutenant Colonel, go and study what is happening and do your duty." Then he said, "Stop by Dr. Gomez's office and he will give you instructions." But Dr. Gomez, one of his assistants, didn't give Colonel Varela any instructions either. It would be wrong to call this a setup, but neither was it, you know, fair, right, to send in a man to do dirty work and not give him full protection and cover. Not that we should really weep any tears for Colonel Varela. But who is Colonel Varela? He was a radical civic union member. He was a lifelong military man. He was a great admirer of German military discipline. He had studied the German language his whole life. The 10th Cavalry Regiment, like I said, it was created basically for this mission. Colonel Varela had 200 men. They had to raise some more along the way. So they only ever really had, I think, like 300 men, something in that ballpark. They left for Patagonia on January 28th, 1921, while all the general strikes were continuing. Now, strategically, they landed at Puerto Santa Cruz instead of Rio Gallegos, which was, you know, the hot spot, right? And at this stage, the ranchers were coming around to acknowledging the unions, though perhaps this might have been a stalling tactic in their minds. The new governor gave Colonel Varela instructions to resolve the conflict with a minimum of bloodshed, which there's a lot of ambiguity around these and future instructions, let's just say. Meanwhile, the strikers won most of their demands, including amnesty for things that happened during the strikes. The union delegates put it to a vote. 427 in favor of returning to work against 200 in favor of continuing the strike. Mind you, these are delegates, not, you know, total workers. There were many, many, many thousands involved in the strikes. The workers pushed it right to the limit and ended the strike, winning right by when the army got there, thereby winning most of their demands. So this sounds like a victory, right? 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 We can't draw conclusions for the whole story yet, because the story is not over. But as we recounted the story of La Semana Trágica, the tragic week, we saw how upper and middle classes chose to scapegoat the Jews, and to a lesser extent the immigrants, while they endorsed also killing workers. We saw the same social forces at play when we covered Germany, and we saw the formation of similar groups like Thule, the Viking Bund, and the Nazis. And we saw, yet again, the role of navies in organizing these groups, because of course the Argentine Navy organized the Patriotic League, right? We saw how Patagonia was neither owned nor inhabited nor worked by natural-born Argentines. Of course, also not by, like, indigenous people, of which, you know, they were mostly killed out in Argentina, unfortunately. And we're talking, like, not worked, owned, or inhabited by natural-born Argentines, even in the rather fluid sense of the term Argentine, because of course Argentina was, you know, like settler colonial like the US, so like, you know, within one generation you're basically like natural born or whatever, at least if you're, you know, European descended, right? And the natural born Argentines did not own the productive industry by and large. British, German, French, Portuguese, Spanish settlers did. Not even like, oh, their families, you know, like, oh, they were born, but they, like, no, these were literally, like, British people, Germans, Spaniards running these ranches, right? And then there's that quote, power in Patagonia hinged on the following formula, land plus wool production plus commercialization plus control of transportation. That's power in Patagonia. Of course, that's pretty much the formula that the British Empire used. And that was what they were doing in Patagonia. You get the land, you get the wool, you sell the wool, commercialization, plus control of transportation. Obviously the high seas, shipping, all of that, right? Then we saw how these waves of strikes were set off or able to succeed during a major economic crisis. This is a complicated bit of a chicken and an egg situation where you have to ask whether the economic crisis caused the strikes or just allowed them to succeed or to spread. You know, it's almost impossible to separate the complex web of interactions between them, but they are all interlocked. And President Irigoyen and his populist politics allowed conditions for the workers' movement to spread, although, as we will see, that is not exclusively a good thing. I'm not saying that the workers' movement spreading is not a good thing. I'm saying President Irigoyen allowing this to spread, his side of things, is not clearly just a good response. Then we saw how internal politics kept the state's repressive response from being coherent and effective. Like, the judge and the Argentine middle classes were fighting with British capital in the legal system, and that prevented the state from responding effectively in putting down the workers. We also saw how the forces of private property will create these paramilitary units to shore up and reinforce the police and military. They've done it, you know, for 100 years. They've done it going back more than 100 years. They're not going to stop. This is just the dynamic. And for some reason, people pretend like this doesn't happen every single time, right? Oh, and I should mention, 68 disappeared into Chile after this first wave of strikes. Never heard from again. We will hear about Antonio Soto and El Toscano in the next episode, when we find out what happens to the Patagonian Revolution. For sources today, I used the book Rebellion in Patagonia by Osvaldo Bayer. To a lesser extent, I used the book Simone Radowitzky and the People's Justice, and the book the anarchist expropriators, and to a much lesser extent, the graphic novel Prisoner 155. I cannot recommend Osvaldo Bayer's books enough, especially Rebellion in Patagonia. The Anarchist Expropriator is extremely good too. I already talked about a lot of Radowitzky, you know, in episode 9. Thank you for listening though, dear listener, my serial chillers. You are already on the premium side, so just tell a friend about the show. See you next week, and God bless.